Well, the hymn that we sing that speaks very much to the topic of what we're looking at this evening. Hymn, of course, there, imploring God's blessing upon preachers, those who minister, as I'm doing, standing in a pulpit or wherever they stand to preach the word of God. We're out in the streets of Heena yesterday. God willing, a few weeks on, we'll be on the streets of Belper preaching there and on into the spring. Well, I'll talk spring here, beginning of February. Let's talk these things. But anyway, continuing to preach, we trust, on through this year. And we're in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, and verses 1 to 6. The title is this, The Genuine Article. The Genuine Article. We'll see in a moment how Paul is moved here, out of necessity, to defend himself, to defend his ministry, his character, all he is doing, as being genuine, as opposed to the criticisms that are being made against him. What has his ministry been doing? Well, we can see in chapter 1. Chapter 1 is, in effect, something of an introduction, an encouragement, because he is stating before them there that their coming to them, as we see it in verse 1, was not in vain. It was not in vain. There had been great outcomes. The church had been established. Lives, people, real people, have been remarkably changed. And we saw how they'd abandoned their idolatry, all of their interests in these kinds of things, inert, lifeless idols. They'd forsaken those and were now cleaving to the living and true God. And they now believed in the true God. Their whole horizon now was no longer idols, but they saw through that and past that and held something of the excellence of the true God. And moreover, too, awaiting his Son, they had found him to be their Saviour, knew that he is coming to judge the world, that he is the risen Christ, seated at the right hand of God, and one day to be coming again, to be seen on this earth, not coming in the state of humiliation, his first arrival in Bethlehem, but one that will be full of signs and wonders and the sky and the stars and the heavens. What a day it will be. So chapter 1 is actually something of an introduction and an encouragement. It is, in a way, preparing for what chapter 2 is now going to have to deal with, because the whole tone changes there, doesn't it? And from having described the church and spoken of how it draws Paul's affection, and he remembers without ceasing all their work of faith and labour of hope, labour of love and patience of hope. So he then has to move on to address some very real issues which had come to his attention. But he wants to establish this fact, that they are genuinely changed because they have experienced a genuine ministry, genuinely done in the power of the Holy Spirit. It was only by that power, as a result of the underlying case of their election, that they now were the people that they are and are hearing now from Paul in this letter. And so from that, having established the reality, the credibility of their life-changing experience, a change which was reported throughout all of the churches in Macedonia and Achaia, they were all speaking about what had happened at Thessalonica. So from the credibility of everything that chapter 1 is evidence of, Paul then moves to have to defend his own ministry and to show that his character, his motivations, the whole of his intent was pure and genuine, that he was not, as some are accusing him of, rather deceiving, rather duplicitous, a man that could not be trusted. And thus he is having to defend himself. And it's with that I want to stay for our first point, and that's entitled Different Cases. Different Cases. We'll find Paul is having at some length here. I'm only dealing with the first part of it in the first six verses because there's more that follows. He, in a way, states the case negatively. Lots of what we did not do, this was not true of us, that was not true of us. And from verse 7, he begins to express more positively what he did do while he was there. So he's ruling out certain alternatives, the criticisms that are made, and saying, well, we did not do that, and that was not in our thinking, and that was not our motivation. And he has to speak about these things, as elsewhere on occasion, at some length. And we might wonder, when it is right for us to, if you like, defend ourselves, speak up what we're doing, who we are, be able to speak quite so boldly, perhaps, about those things, and when we perhaps should stay silent under some provocation or something that is said against us. And so it's really quite superficial, isn't it? Because how many situations we can meet and encounter, and all the nuances and ways in which you'd have to differentiate. Well, we'll be here, I'm sure, a week trying to prise apart all those different intricate situations. No one situation's alike, is it? There's always another angle that requires a certain principle to be brought into it that wouldn't have to be brought into another situation. But just to think about what it is and where it is that we might be moved to defend ourselves, perhaps have to do it quite strongly, as Paul is having to do it here. He's doing it quite strongly. And we find, what were the accusations? Well, his inspired ability to summarize, they're there in verse 3. Our exhortation did not come from error or uncleanness, nor was it in deceit. And we might imagine those are the kind of main headings of the criticisms that are being made about Paul. Remember, they had persecution. There was great threat to Paul's life and his colleagues. They had to leave the city, as he's referred here in Philippi, much the same that they faced there in Philippi, the awful treatment they had from the magistrates and being put in prison and so forth. And having moved away from the city, been away from them for some time, well, that was a time for mischief, wasn't it? And people were able to begin to ask questions about Paul, his character. Well, where is he? Why hasn't he come back? He just starts this thing and he's gone. And rather forgetting the persecution that he faced, and that the brethren had to, as it were, encourage him to leave the city in the first place. But they were able, in Paul's absence, to get a little bit of leverage, a little purchase with the people, and to begin to introduce some bad thoughts to them about Paul's character. And it is from this that he has to, as it were, distill the main headings of it in verse 3. So, error. It's a false teaching that he was bringing, that's what some were saying. And he just made it all up. That it was just some fancy story to impress gullible people, and that was a way of coming to them. That manner of entry that Paul speaks of, that actually produced such lasting fruit, i.e. their conversion. But no, this was being scotched. And the people were saying, well, that wasn't it at all. There was a false teaching. He was here coming to us with these empty words, some story, some fable that he'd made up. And that's what it was all about. Therefore making the people doubt that what they'd heard was reliable, that it was true, that it could be the foundation for their life, and indeed the foundation for their hope of eternity. So these negative thoughts, first of all, were being made. Uncleanness. Something unclean about Paul. And, well, it was probably something along the lines of it was money. That he was interested in money. Cloak for covetousness, verse 5. That uncleanness connected up with motives that were for his own good progress, for his own self-aggrandizement. That he would accumulate money from these people, having told them this fancy story. And that this is all part and parcel of the whole man. And that then was in deceit, that he's fundamentally dishonest. Fundamentally dishonest. Treatment of the people, the stories he makes up, and the fact he's just exploiting them for money, well, sums it all up. He's a deceiver. And so these were the thoughts that were circulating, making out these things. Well, we did a few months back, I guess it is now, when we're doing this part of 2 Corinthians, but in our Bible studies, we've been looking in 2 Corinthians, now completed it, but we were seeing there how often Paul had to mount a fairly strong, robust defence of himself and go toe-to-toe with false teachers making their claims, and by their own actions and words, making claims against Paul. And we see him speaking there, taking the words of his critics in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10, and sort of quoting them. For his letters, Paul's letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech contemptible. He takes on, head on, the criticisms that are being made that, well, his letters, they concede, have got some depth, some weight to them. They're powerful things. But the man himself, well, his bodily presence is weak and his speech is contemptible. Doesn't have the oratorical flourishes of the big names in Corinthian culture, the people that pull the crowd and have them eating out of their hand with all their flourishes and all of their clever sophistry. Paul couldn't match them for that. Didn't have that commanding presence that, you know, he just stood there and conveyed a kind of authority, a sort of self-possessed man in that way, and could just wow everybody by his stature. Well, Paul couldn't match them for that. But Paul goes on in that same chapter, the next verse, in fact, to say, well, let such a person, this is what they're saying, consider this, that what we are in word by letters when we are absent, such will also be indeed when we are present. If they find his speech, his delivery, lacking some of the kind of intricacy and the cleverness of the Corinthian speakers, and find what he is, his stature and his appearance, to be kind of less than amazing, well, if they reckoned that his letters are weighty and powerful, they'll find actually, when he comes to visit them, if they haven't repented, that he would be indeed weighty and powerful to them in what he had to tell them. So we see elsewhere that he is having to stand up for himself and having to defend himself and his ministry. And as we perhaps just try to think, well, when is it appropriate to do this? Because in many ways we might shy away from it. We might feel that we wouldn't really want to have to do this. It comes very unnaturally in a way to us there, and that's in many ways would speak well of us. And we felt that we'd rather not have to fight our corner or defend ourselves. And so surely there are times when silence is what is the best policy. But on other occasions, actually, well, what might even seem self-justification, self-defense, speaking up, contending, refuting, challenging is what is needed. Sometimes it is that place to write a letter that may be towards somebody somewhere that puts some things that actually need to be said, and where we have to defend our record and bring to people's attention certain things that may have escaped their attention. So there is a time and a place then for what Paul is doing here, defending himself. So what might we say? Again, we're having to generalize, but how to assess cases, if you like, how to perhaps recognize when something appropriate is to be done or said, and maybe when there's nothing to be said. Well, perhaps one question we might first ask ourselves is, what is under threat here? What is under threat, and how important is it? Is the thing under threat important? Well, sometimes, isn't it? It's just something that somebody says against us personally, and it doesn't travel any further than ourselves. It's not something that people are broadcasting everywhere. It may be an off-beam comment. It might be quite an unkind comment. It might be a totally untrue comment. But if the implication is simply to us, and the only damage that's going to be done is probably to our pride, then we might quite easily, quite comfortably, smile politely and say nothing. Nobody else is injured in the process. Nobody else has heard this thing. It hasn't been spoken, voiced publicly, but it's just something that's reached our ears, and we might be very minded just to let the whole matter pass and view it as a moment for our sanctification. We can ignore it, or even, perhaps, by some gentle engagement, try to win the person over to a more positive view. We might ask, is it actually true? What's been said? Well, it may be true. Maybe partly true, half true, there may be some grain of truth in it, and it's worth extracting that and learning the good that there is from it, repenting, considering again things, being willing to change. So if it's only us, our reputation is under threat, it's not something that's been voiced elsewhere, it's not doing any wider damage, the only one, as I say, that's coming under a little attack is our own pride, well, then we can perhaps quite safely leave it. But does it affect other people? If what is said is going to affect other people and begin to make them look, wonder, ask them questions, become negative, well, then maybe there is something further to be done. It's going to affect our wife, our husband, our children, our work colleagues. It's going to affect our church, our reputation, or our standing, our unity. Then there are things to perhaps do, a little bit more of a muscular approach, if you will. Does it undermine relationships within the church, say, or trust, or our cooperation? Does it sow seeds of unnecessary and unwelcome doubt? And particularly if those things are not especially true, and those things are not voiced there in a way that coordinates with the facts of the matter, then we might be moved to respond. Does what is being said affect our gospel witness? Is what is being said, perhaps outside the church, people who might have taken on it themselves to say something negative about the minister or member of the church or some aspect of what we do, does it make people out there think ill of the church? Does it have an effect that could really undermine the gospel ministry, the credibility? That if people are looking and thinking, well, is that the kind of people that they are? Is that how they behave? Those are the sorts of things that are done and so forth from former ministers or whatever else. Well, then sometimes there is something that does need to be said. And sometimes there is something that needs to be put across if an appropriate context for it can be found. So what is under threat? Is it just us and our own pride or something like that? Is it really quite trifling when we analyse it and just consider it? Or is there something more important at stake? Is it going to undermine trust? Is it going to be damaging to our cooperation? Or is it indeed, travelling further on, actually got the potential to damage the gospel and our witness? The next thing perhaps to ask is this, and we ask it of ourselves. How secure am I in my response? Putting it like that, how secure am I in my response? How well do I know myself? Can I validate what is being said? Can I step away from myself? Or am I going to be too embroiled in it, too defensive, too drawn into it, that in fact I'll not really be able to discern and kind of discriminate what's going on there within my own heart? We said before that, putting it like this, Paul has got to the bottom of his character. He knows himself. God who tests the hearts, he says. God who tests our hearts. That he himself has been through a rigorous training program to understand himself, to detach from the former things that he regarded important, all of the trappings of being the Pharisee and with all his zeal and everything he was doing in those days, which he reports to the Philippians, he now comes to count as rubbish for the excellence and the glorious knowledge there of Christ instead. Those things he now counts as rubbish. He's moved away from that, those idols, those things that were deep within his soul that gave him perhaps a sense of achievement, a sense of status and accomplishment. Well, these now had been demolished. And he knew it, and he was happy indeed that they had gone. He regards them now as just causing him huge mischief and actually shutting him out from heaven. He got to the bottom of his character, understood himself, done some excavation, performed some surgery, and got to some of those hidden attitudes and those things that we respond to overly quickly, prickliness, defensiveness, some area of vulnerability. We rather imagine that the apostle had been put through a very, very rigorous training program to fit him to be able to go out into this work of apostleship and to be able to cope with all the brickbats that would come flying his way, as they had here in Thessalonica, and as they did pretty much everywhere that he went. He got to the bottom of his character. He knew who he was. He was able to subject himself to rigorous scrutiny, to have a good look at himself, and still be able to say, no, I'm doing this not to please men, but to please God. Is it? I'm not pleasing men, he says in verse 4, but God, who tests our hearts. He's not saying this casually. God tests our hearts, and he's not talking in an abstract way. He's talking as he's been through the process. He's a man who's been through that process, and he's come to know himself better, understand the things he's got wrong in the past, and put those aside now, move on. His character is developing and forming through that sanctifying process. And it's important that we know ourselves, that we are more and more secure in who we are, and in, therefore, how we respond. To know our hearts, to recognise our weaknesses, vulnerabilities, needs, to know when it is an issue, that this is often an issue that comes up, we might think, and here it is again, and it's poking around in an area there where I feel vulnerability, and I often can feel very weak and on very shaky ground. That we recognise that, and that we are able to moderate and temper our response before we go into some massive introspective meltdown or say something too quickly that we will regret, get angry about something, say too much, and find that we're losing the battle there, if you will, and losing an opportunity perhaps to respond more constructively, losing control. And so we need to be secure in ourselves in that way, to have got somewhere towards understanding ourselves, what things we always feel a bit sad in ourselves about, what things, when we're reminded of them, cause in us a little distress and a sense of weakness, and be able to counter that a bit, recognise it, and respond in a way that is appropriate if that's the area that we suddenly find ourselves under pressure in. Conceding what needs to be conceded, and to do it comfortably, to do it happily, cheerfully indeed, but also being willing to come back and to make the point that we might have to make. So we need to be aware of our fears, our defensiveness, prickly pride, the personal battles that still rage within us that we've not yet gained mastery over. How often in the life of churches, and I won't name where the places are that I could, where I fear that jealousy has ripped into the heart of the church, and the people have been jealous of the gifts of other people, and it's left them feeling unhappy or insecure, and they've lashed out and said unhelpful things, and it's escalated into perhaps a sad church division or something like that. And these are things where, again, we have to test our own hearts, that people who speak to us or write to us or say things to us, that we ourselves are not, why am I jealous of them? Find that we're reacting negatively because in some way it's touched a raw nerve. So how secure am I? How secure in my self-knowledge and therefore in the response that I can give, that it's not going to just generate within me a massive kind of inner meltdown, inner turmoil, a sort of descent then into a kind of depression or anxiety kind of trail, or, on the other hand, to generate a heated reaction, a heated response. How secure are we? And then the third point, of course, is this. Who are the people that perhaps are being negative or who are saying the things that they are saying? And the more secure we are in who we are, the better we can actually answer that question. What kind of people are they? What's motivating them? And we can step back from the immediacy of what's been said and all the turmoil that's caused us and the jangling in our system and response that might want to lash back or say something quite tart and strong or run away and hide and say go into some sort of meltdown. That we can look, well, who are these people? What is actually motivating them? And if we can get nearer to an answer to that question, how might they be won over? Gentle word, perhaps, by some reasoning, by some reasonableness. Or are they hardened? Are they hardened? And we may always proceed on the assumption that there is something to be gained by a gentle word and by offering politeness and a bit of good humour or something like that. But we may find that we're having to revise our estimates as we proceed and find that perhaps our gentle approach is just meeting with more opposition and obstinacy and insult, and far from actually doing anything, it's actually going the other way, and that we have to revise our estimate. Sometimes, when people perhaps are negative or critical, we might be moved always, as a default setting, to think the worst of ourselves. It's us. It's our fault. We are the problem. And I tell you this, that wicked people, bad people, can play upon the fears, the timidities, and the lack of boldness, and the lack of confidence, the self-doubts of others, the willingness of others to be charitable and persuadable, to be given easy sort of way in which to introspectively look at yourself. And people will feed us lines in that way. If they sense we're that sort of person, I'm afraid they're manipulative people out there who will only too happily get us going down that trail. Sometimes we need to actually work with the stereotype. Sometimes some of the things that are said about people and their ways and the stereotype works very nicely for them. Maybe a negative stereotype, but the cluster of behaviours and attitudes and what we can see, and perhaps over a period of time what we have seen, and the stereotype there works only too well on them. Often it's the case, isn't it? It's not just what people say, but it's how they say it. It's how they come across. It tells us something perhaps about the character of the person. And so we need to be alert. Are we dealing with hardened people, winnable and teachable people? Or are we dealing with people here, or are they dealing with us and interacting with us? And there's actually some progress that we can make, some ground that can be made, and where we can move into perhaps a more comfortable situation. Well, that is but a brief hurry through. Just a few kind of headings, perhaps, a few things to weigh up. Because my next heading is this: Paul defends himself, establishing himself as the genuine article. So how has he come to the response that he has, that he's got to say something, that he's got to, at some length, actually defend his record and speak up the things that he hadn't done, as it were, and defend himself against those accusations, but also speak up the things he had done? What was the danger? Was it important? Well, it was. Because if you undermined Paul, you undermined the gospel. And if you undermined the gospel, the truth of that gospel, then that would be the end of the church in Thessalonica. That he was not actually having to defend himself here, personally, as defend what he had done in Thessalonica, so as to assure them of its reliability, of its truthfulness and veracity, that this was a genuine work of the Spirit, that he, Paul, is not a fly-by-night there, but that they too are the genuine article arising from a genuine ministry. But if he didn't defend himself and allowed these words, criticisms, to just pass unchecked and circulate around a sort of rumour mill of Thessalonica, then it would perhaps destroy the church. It would destroy them. And we would find that their coming in the end was in vain. The next thing, how about Paul? Well, we've been saying, haven't we, that he is a man who knows himself. He knows himself. He knows what motivates him. He's gone through that self-check, that process of self-inquiry, that self-watch and understanding of his character. And so, not that we're looking particularly at that verse tonight, but he is able to say that God is also his witness. Verse 10, you are witnesses and God also. God also. Well, that is saying something. You believe so convinced that your own bearing, your own standing will bear scrutiny, that God himself would bear you out on this. Well, then he has a clear conscience. He understands himself. He knows. He knows those things that are said against him are untrue. And he knows the people who are saying it. And he's not going to spare their blushes. We read on into verses 15 and 16. Here's his assessment And it's a fairly negative assessment of those who were passing these criticisms round. For he speaks of these people, these folk there and their negativity, Judeans and others, who killed both the Lord Jesus and their own prophets and have persecuted us. They do not please God and are contrary to all men, forbidding us to speak to the Gentiles that they may be saved, so as always to fill up the measure of their sins. The wrath has come upon them to the uttermost. Well, he assessed those who were creating the damage and likewise assessed that they required a fairly robust response. That these people were not animated by ignorance or a bit of misunderstanding. There was something very inveterate. They hardened about their attitude and they were out to kill. So Paul, in this situation, didn't, as maybe moved, it can sound very spiritual to say, well, we'll leave it to the Lord, we'll do nothing, we'll pray and do nothing further than that. And sometimes we need to pray and then act. So truth does not always just take care of itself. Sometimes God requires us to be the assistants in bringing truth to light, that our words and our actions are sometimes called upon to establish that truth. What does Paul do? What's he doing in this section? He's appealing to facts. That's what he's doing. He is appealing to facts. He is appealing to evidence that any reasonable-minded person, underline that, reasonable-minded person, would have to say that they agree with Paul. But what Paul is saying, on the balance, everything else considered, is true. And this appeal to facts, well, it's also then an appeal to their conscience. Because if you're appealing to facts, you're appealing to evidence, and therefore a reasonable person looking at the evidence would have to agree. This would be to go against their conscience to disagree. Because conscience, when it's working properly, agrees with the facts of the matter. When he goes against the facts, then it knows it, and it starts screaming, this is a lie you're believing, and you're telling a lie, in effect, by allowing it to circulate. And so Paul is appealing to the facts, and therefore appealing to their conscience. And we can see this, because how often he says simply what he then puts to them, you yourselves know. You already know all of this. I'm not telling you anything new. You know all of this. So it's there in verse 1. For you yourselves know, brethren. Puts it to them there. And then again in verse 2. As you know, we told you about this, what has happened in Philippi and our troubles, how we were spitefully treated, as you know. And how after that, even after that, we were bold in God to speak to you. Despite the troubles we'd had, we still came to you and spoke, preached boldly to you. And then again in verse 5, neither at any time do we use flattering words, as you know. He's appealing to the facts. You know this. Only telling you what you know. And again, if we cast our eye down to verse 11, as you know, how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you. And just slightly varying it, but verse 9, for you remember, brethren, our labour and toil. And again, he is appealing to the facts. Maybe jogging their memory here and there to get them back on message. And oh yes, I remember now, breaking the spell that had been cast by these critics who were against Paul. And Paul just goes back to the facts and reminds them that these are facts that they already know, that he's not telling them some fresh, startling revelation about himself, but is simply telling them the straightforward facts. And it's good to appeal to the facts. Why? Well, people do forget. They forget what they actually know, and memories can fade a bit and need the odd jogging. And Paul is jogging their memories here, even though it's only a few months since he saw them, but he's been very generous to them, and treating them like reasonable people, indeed rightly so, because they respond as reasonable people. And they're knit to him. They have good memories of him and affection for him. But we appeal to facts because people forget quickly. And also because people don't always realise what they know and what its implications are. That they might have some knowledge of something, but it needs organising. It needs, if you will, to enable people to see the wood for the trees, you know, to be able to get to the heart of the matter. People can have sort of impressions and different bits and pieces, but it needs bringing together. And so Paul, by succinctly describing his behaviour, can summarise it for them, can bring together disparate parts of their perceptions and their memories and give it a context which they can perhaps then recognise and begin to see that what's being said against him is totally untrue. And also Paul recognises human nature. People get swayed so easily. There's some criticism here, some negativity there, and opinions get swayed. We can move around like a weather vane. We're going to blow in this way, and then blown back that way, and blown that way again. And Paul is having to sort of recover any lost ground that they've given an ear to these false teachers. They looked at Paul and wondered. And so he's having to pull them away from that false impression that they had fallen to. People are easily swayed, so it's always good to appeal to the facts, to let the facts speak for themselves and to win a hearing. So good results, that's one of the outcome of the facts, just very briefly. They showed that the apostle's work was genuine, good outcomes, and there were good motives that the apostle could truly appeal to. Not personal gain. He wasn't there for pleasing men. Not the glory from men, he says in verse 6. He's not looking for acclaim. He's not looking for applause. He's not looking for a big platform. He's not looking to be able to have a comfortable life. He describes how they were treated in Philippi, but that didn't stop him. He's back now in Thessalonica preaching the same things. He's not saying, well, I won't preach that again. That caused trouble. Let's do something different. Far from it. He's preaching as boldly as ever to the people in Thessalonica, even with the experience of Philippi still fresh in his mind. Not in error. He is a workman approved by God in verse 4. Approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. Entrusted with the gospel, not his own fables or fantasy fiction. This is genuine. And God is able to entrust the gospel to this man because God is testing his heart. He's put him through the ringer. He's had to get to the bottom of his character. And so he's a reliable man to be the bearer of this great and wonderful truth. So it's not money, as we've mentioned. And he mentions also in verse 6, and we'll pick this up again, God willing, next week. He doesn't make demands. He wasn't there in verse 6, he says, making demands as apostles of Christ. He calls upon his title, doesn't he? An apostle, appointed first in the church, apostles, then prophets. He's a man of some authority, man of some weight. And yet he doesn't throw that weight around. He's not there kind of bossing people around or expecting them to do this, that and the other for them. And that again also speaks of his genuineness. It's not a power trip. It's not a kind of likes to have followers. That's a killer one there in the ministry. It really is. People want to have a big following, 100,000 Twitter followers there hanging on your every word, that sort of thing. And some of those people make some pretty horrible demands of their churches and their people, bossing people, complaining everywhere. So he wasn't behaving like that. Well, he's the genuine article. Ministers, but then all of us need to search their own hearts, don't we? That we're the genuine article, that we're in what we're in and doing what we're doing for all the right motives, as best as we can discern. And if they're not the right motives, to move ourselves into a position where sanctification can make them the right motives, and that we can be there as a credible witness for these things. Remember, others are watching us. We have humanists, we have atheists, we have any number of ists, and this is that. And they're watching us, and they want to know, is it genuine? They're really trying as hard as they might to believe that it is not genuine, that we're not for real, that we're in it for money, that there's a fairy tale all made up, that we're just deceivers there, manipulating simple-minded people, and the rest of it. We need to be a genuine article, reaching out to people, interacting with non-Christian people, amongst ourselves, in our own dealings with each other, that truly indeed we might be attested, tested by each other, yes, but moreover attested by God, that God could be our witness, our conscience could be that clear that we could assert this, that we're genuine and that we're real and that we're here to serve God and to seek his glory. So may we be enabled to be those very things, a high calling indeed, isn't it? But those very things to the glory of God. Well, we finish there and we sing next hymn. But we'll sing our next hymn. We may. 690, for a heart to praise my God. 690.